Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the June 2024 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research. And here with the PCRF Journal Club, we take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. A big thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts. And we want to bring you the best of science in medical education. I'm Megan Corey. I'm here with David Page, Michael Caduce, and Dr. Bill Toon. And today we are going to discuss this article entitled A No-Brainer. By the way, this wins for the best title of an article, at least this year. A No-Brainer, The Power of Cadaver-Based Instruction to Teach Clinical Neuroanatomy. And this was published in November of 2023 in the American Journal of Speech and Language Pathology. So thank you all for joining us today. We're going to begin. We want to remind you that you can use the chat feature on your screen to type in questions and chat amongst yourselves. And then you can also use the Q&A and we can bring those into the conversation as we go. Remember, if you miss any of these journal clubs, you can visit our YouTube, our dedicated YouTube page. It's at youtube.com/@PCRF@UCLA. And we have our very own channel where you can get all of the past podcasts. But now before we begin, I'd like to bring on David Page. We're going to have a couple of announcements. 2 days left. 2 days left.
Announcements, announcements. This is a scout camp coming out. PTSD, whatever. This is the final, these are the final hours. June 30th, 2024 is our deadline for research abstracts being submitted. I want to tell you, Megan, it is a banner year.
Yes.
We have more abstracts this year than any other year. So the competition for best, abstract winner of is going to be a very challenging but very fun grading and peer review. So if you have research just kind of hanging out somewhere in your corner, or you were thinking, oh, I still have a couple of weeks to get that done, now's the time to just kind of wrap it up in a bow, put it into the website. We offer a $500 cash prize for the winner of best research. We have one for clinical, one for educational. This is the educational podcast. So if it's educational, you can put it in here. I can see that there are names that are on this podcast that are participating that have done research with us before. And so you cannot hide, Mike Boldra. All right, so time to put it in there, Jeff Ritz, we want your abstracts. So the other amazing benefit of this is $2,000 in travel grant money to support the researcher presenting the abstract at an international conference. We have agreements and relationships with the EMS Asia conference. They'll have a February, I believe, conference in Thailand. And then in May, usually in the spring, there's something in the UK. If not, Australia is an option. So the Canadians are joining us this year. So we exchange the winner of their best research comes to the International Scientific Symposium at EMS World Expo in Las Vegas this year on the 9/11 anniversary. So it should be pretty intense and timely. So please submit your abstracts. Submit your abstracts. We want your research and it'll get presented in Las Vegas. And if you don't have an abstract, never fear. We will get you an abstract. If you want to participate in a workshop, please sign up. This one is the latest of our workshops with ESO, an amazing partner and supporter of all of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum research and education that we do. So you come with an idea, you leave with an abstract. And in this case, ESO has linked patient care records with outcomes. So we know what the hospital outcome was. And all you need to do is show up. There's no fee except for whatever you're going to spend on travel, which is your responsibility. But it is in Austin in September. Abstracts created there could go to future conferences after that and papers. But it is an amazing experience. 3 days, no cost. We feed you. We love you. It's just a cathartic experience of, you know, the speed dating version of research where you can just show up with an idea and then boom. So,
you know, they could go back and look at some of the YouTube archives and come up with ideas. Maybe I could do this. Maybe I could pose this question.
Yes, absolutely.
Which would be great. Look through some of the other abstracts that have been published.
Mm-hmm.
Good ways to generate ideas.
So June 30th is the deadline to apply. Mm-hmm. So operators are standing by. And we are on track, just so people know, if September 25th is just not an option for you in Austin. We are on track to have a research workshop with Weinman, sponsored by Weinman, at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee in February. That might be a little cooler than Austin in September, but hey, we're there to do research, not ice fish. And then NEMSIS is also coming on board, and we anticipate a workshop in November in Salt Lake City that's focused on trauma. So the Wisconsin Research Forum will be just on ventilation research, the one in Salt Lake City, we think in November, is going to be entirely focused on trauma, particularly post-crash care, which is a research interest from NHTSA this year. So there's funding. And if there's funding, there's research.
Yes.
So we love that. Onward, commercial over.
That's great.
Well, September. We want you always to be part of this.
Yes. June 30th. Be there, be square. Okay, so let's get into this article today. So first, I do want to take a minute and recognize the amazing work of speech and language pathologists. You can see this is from the American Journal of Speech and Language Pathology, which may make you think, what? Why are we looking at this? Well, because it's cadaver-based instruction. It's neuroanatomy, certainly related to EMS preparation. So I do want to recognize their amazing work because I, like many people, had no idea of the depth and breadth of their practice, speech and language pathologists, and therefore the educational background that leads to their practice. So I do have the fortune of having an SLP on our campus that's been a regular guest lecturer on neuroanatomy of language and application to aphasias. They also can review airway anatomy in great depth, swallowing deficits, their potential impact on aspiration and stroke patients and subsequent infection. Just an amazing connection that you can have to your airway lectures and to your neuroanatomy of stroke and things and care of stroke. So I just put this up. This is a meme from the speech pathologist world that I appreciated because we're always saying that, you know, people don't understand us. They don't know what we do. Well, SLPs can definitely identify with that. So I think this interprofessional connection helps us value one another's field of expertise. So I thought that was kind of a cool meme. What, you know, the whole what my mom thinks I do, what society thinks I do. Notice what I actually do, paperwork. So that being said, the SLP education does involve an intensive review of neuroanatomy. And education on neuroanatomy can take a lot of forms. As we know, you can have lectures with two-dimensional images. You can have labs with organ dissections and cadavers. all kinds of things that we'll talk about today. And then some evidence indicates that, this is from the medical literature, that learning through cadaver labs results in improved learner retention. So this group wanted to test that out in their communication sciences program and their potential, future SLPs. So they hypothesized, and this was what I thought was cool. They proposed these research questions, but they also hypothesized that cadaver labs, as compared to lecture-based learning, would result in greater improvement in learning, that both would pre- and post-test resulting in learning, but that cadaver labs would result in greater improvement. They also, though, hypothesized that lecture before lab might serve as a pre-learning or a priming opportunity. Now, how many times have we said that? I know I've said it. Well, we'll have, a short lecture followed by the lab, 20 or 30 minute interactive lecture followed by, lab. It's that, and we use the term priming a lot. We're going to prime them with some material, and then, or now we're doing it kind of hybrid wise. We'll get them some content, and then they'll come like a pre-lab and come to lab. So these are their research questions, three of them. To what extent do students demonstrate gains in structural identification following a cadaver lab or lecture? So this is how they're going to measure it. So identification of anatomical regions after a cadaver lab or a lecture. And then they measure that in terms of numbers of attempts and accuracy of labeling after either a cadaver-based lab or a lecture. But then they did something different too. They wanted to look at the order. So does the learning experience offered first, whether it's a cadaver lab first or lecture first, influence the retention of the neuroanatomy concepts? Does it influence the accuracy and the numbers of attempts? And I think numbers of attempts might also get at confidence as well. So that's what they wanted to look at. So they used a methodology crossover design. So everybody's going to eventually get the same education, but what you get first is going to be your group assignment. So they had 54 total students, and you can see it in this crossover design flow diagram. And they had informed consent of the 54 students. The design of what their intervention is very detailed in their lesson plans, it's in their appendices. The lesson plans for both lab and lecture are attached to the article in the appendices, so you can literally pick them up and pull them from them. These are undergraduate majors or post-baccalaureate in communication sciences and disorders. There, you can see that they had 54 total baseline testing of all 54. And then they stratified them by class rank. So after the midterm, they got all their scores. They had two people who were repeating the class, so they put them in separate groups. They fell around the same place on the scoring. They stratified them and made sure that they distributed them, made sure that each one, was equally represented by class rank, each of the groups. So you had a cadaver brain lab end of 28 students and the lecture, which was 26 students. And then they went through their intervention, which we'll go through. And actually, I can say it was a 1 hour. So your 28 students had a 1 hour lab, four stations, 15 minutes per station. Each one had a graduate student presenting with the student's interaction with a whole brain, a mid-sagittal. They looked at whole brain, mid-sagittal, coronal, or transverse sections. It was important because they really made it steady at each of the intervention groups. So the cadaver brain lab had four stations, 15 minutes each, 1 hour total, and each station had a presentation of one element, a whole brain, a mid-sagittal, a coronal, or a transverse. The lecture was 1 hour. It was conducted by the course instructor. So contrast that with the graduate students in the lab. And that course instructor included images of those labeled brain specimens with the same four views, 15 minutes each. So it was very much held steady for each of the groups. A great description of the methods in this paper and a really good attachment of the appendices. So you could see the lesson plans that were followed by the grad students and by the instructor. Then they had testing at three time points. And incidentally, no handouts were provided. So there were no personal handouts for anybody in either of the groups. And they made sure that the people that were in the training didn't have prior cadaver lab training. So they had testing at three time points, baseline testing, and then post-initial training. And you can see that here. So you had baseline testing, then post-initial training, and then a follow-up 1 week after baseline and once crossover training was complete. So they had after the initial training and the post-training testing, the students from one group went to the other. So the people who had the lecture now went into the cadaver brain lab. The people who had the cadaver brain lab now went into the 1 hour lecture. And then they did the follow-up testing. So that was the methodology. I think I got most of that right. And you guys can let me know if I'm missing anything here. One thing they did do was after the entire thing, and we were kind of talking about why after, they had the students take the VARC survey. And the VARC survey is that, self-reported learning style. So Michael is wondering, I know you were wondering, maybe it was a reviewer comment that, you know, of their, that had them say, hey, maybe you should do a self-reported learning style.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I was like, oh, I'm going to go take the VARC now and see if it, see what it says. But I think it'll be interesting. We'll get to the results and there'll be a little bit in there. But I think there continues to be this misconception that this is how people learn and they learn best, despite the fact that there's really limited data to suggest that's actually true. So
yeah,
we'll get to the results if it makes a difference or not and proves us right or wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think the real point of it is not that there aren't self-reported learning styles. People can, I mean, we were talking about it. We get our students come up to us and say, I learn best by doing this, or I learn best by doing that. Whether or not that pans out, that's where the evidence is lacking, that, you know, your self-reported learning style actually correlates to any kind of intervention.
I think it's like my horoscope. I'm like, I'm a Taurus, so that means that I learn better in February or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Well, I'm not sure that the alignment of the stars impacts my learning. And similarly, this is how students report that they learn better. Again, there's really lacking evidence that says my horoscope impacts my learning, just as there's limited evidence to say a self-reported learning style impacts your learning. But we'll see. Maybe their results prove us wrong.
Yeah. And then the thing that I thought was good that they did this, whether it was done because a reviewer said you should do it or whether they decided to do it later. It was done afterwards. So I don't know if anybody would come out different if they did this test before. But the real point was to compare the groups to make sure that you didn't have more kinesthetic learners in the cadaver lab group or more of one self-reported visual learners or an oral learners, auditory learners in the lecture group or something. And so what they did demonstrate was the self-reported primary learning style by group was not different between the two groups, which is important so that you didn't have that as a confounding variable. So I guess that was really the big thing. So let's start looking at then what happened. And then if you guys have any input, just pop on in. The inter-rater reliability was the first thing. It was very strong between the raters who were scoring. So that's always going to be a question too. Is there, a difference between the people who are actually scoring their exams? So what they did was they went through their intervention. And then their testing involved labeling. So they were given a couple of blank, and actually at two time points, I think there's two time points where they were given blanks. At baseline and at follow-up, they were asked to label as many structures as they can within 15 minutes. And they were given blank images of the exact same things that they saw. So this was, if you were live, you had the same pictures. So it wasn't even like they used different images of some, from a different book or anything like that. It was exactly what they saw in whatever intervention they were going to be in. So at baseline, of course, they haven't seen it. So they take a baseline and they were asked to label as many structures as they can within 15 minutes. And then, so at baseline and then later at follow-up, they're given blanks. Interestingly, at the post-initial, so after the initial, before the follow-up, they were given their baseline and asked to correct. A practice that I think is a very good educational practice. You're given back your uncorrected document and asked if you do you need to correct anything based upon what you put in the baseline. So you hand in your baseline, they score it on the side, and then they hand it back to you at post-initial training and say, if you want to correct anything, put a line through it and correct it. And they accepted, you know, they went through excruciating detail about what kind of things they accepted and didn't accept, because you're going to have some variability because this is free writing. It's not matching or multiple drop downs or anything like that. It's actually writing in the labels. So, and then they talked about whether, what was it, illegible or whatever.
Yeah, I thought that that actually that discussion was really fascinating. We live in a world where we have a lot of educators sort of concerned, panicking about the clinical judgment, technically enhanced items on the National Registry, where students are matching, right? They're matching. It's retrieval practice. It's these groups of things go together. And this paper does this amazing job of getting deep into, so is it accurate? Is it, are you remembering the right word? And then how accurately are you matching? And it wasn't, I thought that the creating that rubric, if you will, or grading structure in order to be able to get at the finer differences between just remembering is really kind of a key in this paper. So if you have a super simple, stupid test that says, you know, what's the brain, then you will detect no difference in educational practices, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're asking, your end outcome is measured with an instrument that's just not, you know, sensitive enough to detect a difference. So oftentimes when we see educational projects and they say, well, here's an example, you did a 3D visualization of a scenario and that resulted in improved critical thinking. Well, how did you measure critical thinking? Well, we gave a test. Well, what test was it? And did it really actually measure critical thinking? Mm-hmm. So this is the same in this case. And on that project, believe me, it was really actually measuring, you know, higher order thinking. In this case, their ability to detect a difference between one learner and the other, because they were using a very sensitive instrument to detect accuracy and retrieval memory, is actually part of the yay of the paper.
Mm-hmm. The do-over, the concept of the do-over too, I really like that.
Yeah.
And the do-over without providing the corrections. You have the intervention, and then you hand... You know, so often in EMS training, we're like, okay, we don't have enough time. We're going to do this once and move on. Once you mm-hmm. hit that point, mm-hmm. milestone, that's it. We move on. There's,
yeah,
you know,
you
very
find
little...
the gap, but you never mm-hmm. fill the gap. It's like, yes. Oh, you don't know this, but good luck. You're going to graduate. Diabetic patients, you know, they won't really need your care because you didn't understand that part, but you got cardiac arrest down. So I guess you're going to graduate. I really, you know, this is that sort of special forces concept of like, nobody finishes until they really actually get it right. And find the gap, fill the gap, find the gap, fill the gap. So I love the here's what you thought was right. Now compare it, because it is higher order thinking. It is you're differentiating, you know, just think about the verbs I'm using. You're differentiating between two things and determining how accurate you were and comparing it to other things, bringing in other knowledge, synthesizing. So in terms of, you know, any of the cognitive models like Bloom, you're reaching a better understanding and ability to use the material.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. The whole concept of practice until you can't get it wrong, not practice until you get it right. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And then mastery level learning, right? Trying to master something rather than keep going until you master.
What I don't really love about this was that it was like a week. So I get the kind of initial learning and I wonder how indelible the learning is. Mm-hmm. So if I go to a cadaver lab, there's a just a monumental amount of emotion going through my head. Okay. It doesn't matter how many times I'm there. Someone donated their body to science, and already that's a human, and they're on a table and they're dead. And that's a big deal to me.
Yeah, it
Like
is.
I the smell of it, the experience of it is emotionally impactful. So regardless of what I'm about to do or learn or see, already I'm immersed into the senses, right? And we know that that matters for memory retrieval. So the emotion and the immersion ends up being a very, cathartic kind of a stimulant to, wow, I'm seeing something, and this is happening right in front of me. Now, on top of that, the active learning, which they address in the paper, the concept of structuring active learning, you have to draw a line and actually write the name. You're not just dragging and dropping, which I think we really got enamored with online, and I think it would be great if this paper had actually compared more modern online active learning exercises than just the lecture. We know that lecture isn't that effective, and kind of they've reproven this, but it's been proven so many times, it's like, why even bother? So I love Dr. Flores's comment in he sent a private message here in the chat about why wouldn't you compare this to other tools that are audiovisual and 3D, especially with Oculus or other three-dimensional abilities to manipulate. We see things like the Visible Body Project or the
Working
Anatomage
on,
table. There's a lot of reasons why, we could have they could have compared other things that might have been more effective. But going back to the sort of experiential part of being in a cadaver, a part of it is just a respect of human life that it is hard to teach. And I wonder how much of that emotion is involved in this partly this retrieval memory piece. So I love that their instrument was sharp, just to bring it to a close, and that they explained how sharp it was, and the ability for the students to go back and fix it. So
Bill Toon, did you have a comment? I saw your audio connecting, but I wasn't sure if you were had a comment. That might have been just an audio.
no, I was switching from phone to computer.
I think you raise it, the authors do raise the issue of using cadavers and the importance of and what it can contribute. They didn't measure that as part of this research, but they do have a couple of mentions of an opportunity to discuss donors and connect with the human aspect of it. So I think that that piece does put the cadaver lab itself over. To the side compared to the tables in the virtual reality. But we had that discussion. I'm so glad to hear from somebody listening that we had the discussion before we came on. It would be nice to know whether two things. One is during a lecture using the 3Ds like visible body and those things instead of two-dimensional images makes a difference. And then the other is in the lab, which they actually have a great discussion about the lab itself too, about the interactivity, the small group learning, the connection between the students. There's that whole thing piece of it too that is different, the one-on-one with a graduate student, and then whether that could, did that have to be a cadaver? Could it be an organ? Can it be a an iPad with a three-dimensional image? Can it be a virtual reality, program? So all of those questions came up. And guess what, folks? Those are all research questions. Get to work. So anyway, let's look at these results a little closer and then we can bring those up. But those are just all, there's a bunch of research questions in there. And maybe there's some research out there we can start looking at too related to that. Okay, so this figure actually shows pretty much their results, but then they break it down into each table because first they separate out the two different measures by total labeling attempts on the left here, and then by numbers of accurate labels. Then they did what's called a linear mixed model, and I'm not even going to approach attempting to explain that unless somebody else can, but they really wanted to look for the interaction between group and time point, because if a person, you know, you could say, well, the accuracy is going to be affected by the number of labeling attempts. If you attempt more, then you're more likely to be accurate. And so they wanted to look at that interaction and kind of tease that out and see if they were actually seeing a true effect. So what you can see from here is you're seeing the comparison, not only by time point, but you're seeing it by group. So is there a change between, first of all, how did both groups do at baseline? Then how did they do it post-initial training and then follow-up? And then the difference between those time points, and then also the difference between the groups when it comes to labeling attempts and the accuracy of labeling. So now we can start looking at the group comparisons or the individual tables. So this first one is the group comparison on the total labeling attempts. And so, I mean, not to bury the lead here, but you can imagine where it's going to be headed. You're going to see a difference between the two groups, lab first versus lecture first. You could see that in the first figure. Both groups improve from baseline to post-initial training. So you see both of those just looking from baseline to post-initial training. They both improve. And then from post-initial training to follow-up, you see, and the remember, this is when they cross over. So they've crossed over to the other side. The interesting thing is we're not seeing the difference between the post-initial training and follow-up in the lab first group, but we are seeing it in the lecture first group, meaning that after they got the lab, they came up. Overall, though, the scores are, you know, again, the difference is seen. There's the advantage is seen in the lab first group. So then they take the view from the point of each group, and they look at time point comparison by mean difference between each time point. So that way you can see post-initial to versus the baseline. So going from baseline to post-initial, the lab first cohort, you can see the gains, but then follow-up versus their baseline, and then follow-up versus their post-initial, not as much of a gain in the lab first cohort versus your lecture first cohort. So I'm wondering what you, Michael, when you were looking at this, you know, what kind of things pop in, you know, what, I wasn't too surprised to see overall the lab first, actually what, the order of things kind of, I was surprised at.
Yeah, I was also a little bit, so all my anatomy and teach and physiology stuff is like, instead of you filling in a picture, if you have access to the cadaver lab, we test in the cadaver lab. So yeah. You do like a pin test or something like that, mm-hmm. as opposed to like, here's the picture. I suppose if you had people, this study was set up such that you didn't have people in the lab. So I guess that maybe makes sense to do it on a piece of paper. I did appreciate, like you shared, Megan, that they, like one was in lower caps, the first attempt, and the second attempt was in larger caps. I was like, oh, that's an interesting way to do that, as opposed to like, you know, doing it in different colors or like scrap, like just put a line through. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. So I guess I wasn't too shocked that the people in the lab probably are going, that would be my assumption, is that you got to sort of model a brain and play with a brain. You'd probably have a little bit better understanding of neuroanatomy than a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
I highlighted something in the, more specifically, the mean group difference at post-initial training was estimated to be 8 times more attempts by the lab cohort first. And I didn't know, and you can help me clarify this. Does that mean they just had more guesses, or that they had, like, it didn't mean like they had more accurate guesses. They just guessed more.
Yeah. They wrote, they took more, they labeled more things basically. Yeah. So I'm wondering if that was, you know, again, are they measuring confidence? Are they measuring, you know, knowledge? And then accuracy is the next thing that they looked at.
Yeah, and 4.4 more attempts by the lab cohort compared to the lecture first cohort at the follow-up testing, which sort of flips it and says, okay, I guess over the long term, the lab group had more guesses. But again, like, I was more concerned about like accuracy. Like, yeah. I can guess all day long. You start giving me brain structures, I'll keep guessing. so I thought those were good. You went to, I had to comment on table three or table four too.
Table four is the accuracy one. So I just
Yeah.
flipped to
Oh,
that, but I can
perfect.
go
That was,
backwards.
yeah, that's a good transition. So what did you make of the accuracy stuff?
So they're saying there's significant differences, or significant group differences at both of the subsequent time points. So we're seeing lab first, and then here, and then lecture first here. And initially, you're seeing kind of the same numbers in accuracy. You're not seeing much of a difference from in the lecture first at, or you do see a difference, from one time to the next post initial training, but you see the greatest gains after follow-up. So after they've crossed over into the other between the initial and the follow-up, and you do see
Yeah.
some gains there as well. Whereas in the, it just seems like the lab first, the lab makes the difference. I mean,
Yeah.
everything here seems like the lab, no matter, no matter where you put it, it makes the difference, but the greater gains are seen when the lab is ha happens first.
And that sort of, I guess, passes my sniff test. I'm sure it passes yours too. Like the people that got to be hands-on in the lab had a could at least replicate the testing environment more. I don't want to say they learned more, but certainly the goal was to test whether they remembered it, and by their testing mechanism, they proved that. I thought it was interesting. The post initial training, we saw the biggest gap, and to that point, the biggest confidence intervals. You saw a wide confidence interval across the board, just generally because it's a small sample size, which doesn't blow our minds. But at follow up, so the lab first group had, and I believe this is an average, a mean of 24.6, and the lecture group had 19.8, so they actually got a lot closer together. And the farther out we got, the lecture group actually like improved by 5 points or 5 questions in essence, where the lab group only improved by about 2.5. So the lecture group actually was sort of like gaining in their knowledge over time. I thought, gosh, I wonder if they're doing review in the classroom. Or like it would seem to me to make sense that this meant the learners were building on what they learned initially. So what you did was you started the initially in the in this class, you got some people a better head start. The rest of the class got there or got close, but these people got a bigger head start. I think that matters, especially if you think as we extrapolate to EMS education, anatomy and physiology are oftentimes first. So this helped you get your students a better, I don't know, head start is sort of what I took from it based on their time intervals and their means, though. I don't know.
Yeah, and this was the so the last table in theirs is gives you kind of the range of scores too, so you can see kind of where their scores were at. That one kind of helped me a little bit. So you see they have significant differences between groups. Again, everybody gains, but it looks like the lab first gains comes out higher here in between. When you're looking at the two, comparing the two groups, if you had lab first, even though everybody had the same education, it was the order of things, they seem to have gained more. And then you look at the range, the ranges are pretty broad. I mean, you're still seeing, again, if you put them on a scale, you're seeing the higher scores in that lab first cohort at follow-up.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I would
even
have
with one of them being 100% or somebody, I don't know how many people got 100%, but that's the
Yeah.
range.
I would have been interested to see, like, what's the difference between a 95 and 100? I don't know, but in our grading scale, that's still an A. That gets you an A across the board. So I'd have been interested to see too if they would have broken this down by how many students got A's, B's, C's, and D's. Because at the end of the day, that's what we count, or that's what the student gets to see. That was my simple thought. I wondered because a same thing, a 63, which is the low score for the lab cohort, and a 39, which is the lecture, are both failing grades. So one substantially lower than the other, but at the end of the day, they're still, there. So I thought that was kind of, I would have liked to seen the breakdown of the grades because the percentages could mean something, but maybe they don't mean anything. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting. I would also thought that for the lab first cohort, the grades went up again about 7%. This is what struck me from the last one. They went up about the same percent on the lecture first cohort. Granted, they started lower and ended lower. They went up about the same. So to me, that tells us something about the testing methods is, again, we got the people a bit of a head start by putting them in the lab, which is good. We want that. That's what we should do. But then over time period they gain the same amount. So to me, there's something there in terms of what are you doing to get your students ahead early on, because they are maintaining the same amount of knowledge as the other group did. So I don't know.
And what instrument are you measuring with? Again, if all you do is memory retrieval, then the gains after the lab are going to be equal, and the students are going to be able to retain because they participate in both things. I find it amazing and want to just continue to tell educators, we're in love with lecture first, and it's just not necessarily actually yielding what we think it does. And so active learning, experiential learning first may be getting us further faster. We did in this podcast an article on from Argawal a few years ago. I was trying to find the link to that podcast so that we could share it in the chat, but that I'll share the paper. The point of that was that quizzing and trying to retrieve that information spurred on better retention. And so using critical thinking type questions early, scenarios early in EMS could improve. Here, cadaver labs seem to really spur a whole lot of synaptic connections and a lot better retention and learning. So if we keep the same instrument and it isn't kind of seeing the evolution of that learning, I don't know. Michael, I think you're on it. I think you agree. You know, it's sort of
The
how to
small
start.
groups too. The small groups. There's so many issues here. Small groups, graduate students, right? Not the sage on the stage, not the expert, you know, whatever. A graduate student. So that's which is, you know, I think probably an expert too, but
Yeah, but
yeah, at what they're
so in the
doing.
paper they talk about 11 students were freshmen, and 11 students were they had all the 11 were freshmen,
Goes
sophomores,
back.
and then there's two that were postdoc kind of. So they all they, just for everybody's also awareness that 52 participants out of 54 were female. So that's another interesting kind of okay. It
Difference.
doesn't, I don't think it would matter here to a male brain versus a female brain. I really don't. And I also want to be, you know, conscious of when we do an experiment and you're going to repeat it, there's some variables there that we're
That's
interested in.
right. That's right. Yeah, they're not a, the demographics they had focused really on male to female and then level of education, and that was pretty much it.
It would have been interesting if they had extrapolated for grade level. I think of the
Mm-hmm.
knowledge I knew as a freshman compared to what I knew as a senior. I mean, that could account for some of these differences too, especially in the terms of like if this is the class you're taking, like first or second year, and you're still learning to study, that has a
Yeah.
huge impact on your learning. We've proven that. So I don't know. I agree with
They
Dave. There's
did a
probably
good
something
job,
there.
though, of distributing, or making sure they were distributed in, equally among groups, I think. But it's a small sample size,
It
right?
is.
So, you know, once you get down to the all of those small groups, then it becomes really small. And they put that in their limitations, of course. This is a single place, a single program. But wow, thank you for to the researchers for producing so many questions that we have. I'm going to take a leap here too, because you're talking, Dave, you were talking about essentially sequencing. So I think sequencing relates to many things that we do in EMS, not just one topic and one lab versus lecture, but what about sequencing in entire programs? We have a
Oh,
real
don't
issue
even
out.
get me started.
I'm
Don't even get me
starting
started.
it. I'm starting it.
I have a fundamental disagreement with several institutions that I love and support around this concept of how It is that we must do didactic first,
Yes.
then hospital, then field.
Yes.
And there's paramedic programs, including the one that I belong to teach in, that are sequenced. So didactic, hospital, field.
Yeah.
And everything that we did I'm now at it for 39 years. So everything that we did when we were interleaving, which is actually an evidence-based practice,
Yes.
shows better retrieval and better use of information and long-term retention performance, et cetera. So instead of blocking, interleaving, braiding, all of that is better. And in the case of clinicals and internships, it just makes perfect sense to have students exposed to the field early,
Yes.
see what they're going to be doing, see how the patients come in, then come back into the classroom and go, what was that? Now, I actually think, Megan, we do this, and we do it very improperly in a very discriminatory way by forcing people to have 6 month experience at an EMT job before they come to paramedic school. So we're actually exposing them to
Yep.
ambulance contact that we want them to actually then be able to
Erase.
retrieve during the call. But for people who are starting in the profession don't know how to get an EMT job, or worse, EMT jobs that really are just transport back and forth to not just they're taking people home from nursing homes or back to their homes.
And they're not being encouraged to utilize assessment skills, right?
Correct. There
So
it's there's
people
not a
who
lot of caregiving.
use them, and people who don't.
So it's very unevenly applied, and
Very.
people who don't have that EMT job or can't get one. In Minnesota, as an example, for many years, you couldn't even get a job as an EMT. It was all paramedic, 911. So it's really hard to get that emergency ambulance experience. And yet, and so we apply it as this block instead of interleaving it and saying, just join. It sort of falls under that same category of why are we requiring EMT before paramedic? Why not just admit people into paramedic school, and at some point they test the EMT and then they keep moving if we really need to have EMT there. So Bill's now on
Chomping at the
camera,
bit.
so I
Come
know
on
I got
in.
him. I know something made
We knew
him
we
go
could make
on
him turn that
camera.
camera on.
Yeah.
I can't disagree with you, Dave. And I was fortunate enough, and I believe there are programs out there that do what you're talking about, you know, and I think they exercise things even a little bit better. But when I ran the primary education program, which was hospital based back in the 80s, we started them very early on with, and we broke our field internship down into phases, and their first phase was just operational. And they started from, you know, they the first day of class, they were already signing up for their ride-alongs. And then we also did, we did things like, you know, after they learned, and again, probably could have done this differently, but after they learned the principles of airway management, they started their OR rotation. They didn't wait it, you know, for that. And then we wanted to, after IVs, they did phlebotomy and then IV therapy. And there was a lot of co-learning that took place. So when we did finally send them to the emergency department or some of the what we considered the bigger clinical areas, they had all that skill stuff out of the way so they could concentrate on the bigger picture stuff, which I thought had great value. I don't know if they
Amen,
still,
brother. Amen.
I don't know if they still do it, but when I went to Seattle, the Resuscitation Academy back in 2010, I did a ride along, and there's two students on the ambulance, which I really like because they make
Love
them work
that.
as
Delaware
partners.
does that too. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
they have
They're
two on
working
there.
with
They
each
make them work as
other.
partners. Yeah, which I thought was great. But the other thing they do is when you're assigned to the ambulance, particularly if you're on, I think it's Medic 1 and 2 that are right across the street from the school, when you're
You're in the
assigned to
ER.
those, when you're assigned to those units, if you're in class and a call comes in, you go on the call. You don't sit in the classroom.
That's
The
right.
priority is the call.
Yeah, the opportunistic learning moment is here now. We can deal with the
Yes.
rest later, including the ER. So the ER is across the street, same story. The medic one, the ambulance is parked in the medical
It's
center.
physically there.
And so the relationship between the medics and the doctors is so tight that there's a paramedic student in the bay. They're going to be in the ER until there's a call. And to me, that it is brilliant. It's just not only do you follow your patient through and are able to have a great collegial relationship with the nurses and doctors, but it's actually the beauty of that experiential learning interleaved with what did you just learn? Go back and study some more. And yeah.
And I shared a paper with you guys that talks about with EM, emergency medicine residents, how a better way to distribute their training versus do
Yes.
it in blocks like they traditionally
Exactly.
do.
I
And
love that
the
paper, Bill. I want to pull that and maybe we'll look at that later this year. It's interleaving in emergency medicine. Love
yeah.
it.
And I thought it was a great example of something again that could be done it well in EMS education and not, and again, I don't think this sequencing of do this, then this, and this is necessarily valuable. When you have it all together, it has greater value. That's just my humble opinion. But I do want to go back and talk about this paper for a minute. And what I really loved about the paper is they really did talk about using the cadaver as that learning tool. And I put a link in the chat. If you've never read the book called The Knife Man by John Hunter, I would encourage you to do it because John Hunter was an early anatomist and physician surgeon. And it talks really about how hard they had to do to teach anatomy, but all the wonderful things that he did. He created all these wax figures of not mannequins, but from cadavers that were used for future study and everything. But it just fascinating compared to what we deal with cadavers now versus then. You could only do anatomy classes in the winter. You couldn't do them over the summer because the smell was too great. You had to have a cold and you had to have a cold environment. But it also talks about that it was outlawed. So there was some of the greatest people who stole did body snatching were early surgeons and anatomists to try to learn from the human body because so there's great stuff there, but it gets back to the value. This is a great value of getting them hands-on. And I think the one of the sad parts that's happened is anatomy, the getting people into the morgue, to see an autopsy. And the more they see, the better the experience is for them and the learning. I was fortunate enough to go to the New York City Medical Examiner's office for their for our mortuary training, and it was phenomenal because they have 10 tables going at one time, and there's a lot of teaching they'll do right at the table while you're there and stuff, and it's a great experience. And there used to be an old video that was on. I think the video was from something called Emergency Medical Update, but they had created a series of autopsy videos, really focused and really well presented towards just paramedics, and that. That we got a hold of those and
I was
used
on the
those
board.
extensively.
I was on the
Remember
board for
those.
Emergency Medical Update. I went down there with
We
Deb
used to use
Cason,
those. Those are
and they
great, but we need a new
phenomenal.
one.
Yes,
Yeah, they're gone. I think of I
totally,
probably still have them
totally.
on
Oh, I
VHS.
have this. I actually used one of those clips that I took off of a VHS tape during my abdominal pain talks, but. You're so right,
Yeah,
and it
you
is so
absolutely are.
impactful to actually see the liver come up out of the body, and you're like, wow, that thing is big.
Those are
Like
fresh
tons of
cadavers,
people
too.
bleed. Very it's amazing, and the educators that in Texas are amazing. We really owe
And
a debt
it was
of
just an excellent, it's an excellent tool because there's some things that are difficult to reproduce year after year in the experience. And so when you can do that, think of the, I'll say another thing is that, and there's probably not a program director on here or an instructor getting male students into the obstetric ward to see a delivery.
Yeah.
How challenging that is. And then what it, you know, if you could ever develop a really well designed one, that
you
would
know,
be
you know,
excellent,
actually, well, two things. First, Anatomage, when I was preparing for this webinar, has a new on their Anatomage table, they have a new model where the mom actually, you can see the development of the fetus into a baby and actually all the way to birth. But I will say this, in your shop in Johnson County, when I was doing a COE site visit, which I hope I'm not going to get struck by lightning for revealing a amazing technique. And I just praise Johnson County Community College for this and all of their educators over the years. So kudos to that entire team. They're amazing. They send their students to the nursery, and the nurses in the nursery show up early to make sure they're there for the birth. And so I saw inordinate numbers of births observed in that paramedic program. And I was like, what do you do? And they don't go to the OB ward. There is no, they're going to the nursery and they just show up early to the birth. So you're dead on as far as amazing and important experiences being smart about how to get them and knowing the social context around gender or gender identity and ability to be in certain spaces. Tim Howie actually did a research project about paramedic students not being allowed, male paramedic students not being allowed to the OB wards. And I'd love to see some interventions there that would be helpful in order to be able to get the paramedics more experience with this. So not just enough to show bias, but how do we, you know, correct the bias and assuage the fears of the moms or the nurses who are saying, you're male and you don't really belong in this room. So somehow, but I do think augmented reality, in this space would be unbelievably helpful. A 3D augmented reality goggle combined with a mannequin where you can have an experience of, whoa, this looks very real. And this is really a baby and I'm putting my hands there. And whoa, with the, you know, I personally, I think that just that would, you know, that's one of those applications that we're waiting for all of it to mesh together and have the technology to do. But obstetrics is I think a great place to do that.
Just a touch, we need to get Rob Terrio here because he's been doing so much work with video, I mean with VR and stuff, and he could really, if you want to talk about someone who's paying attention to it. But there's no question technology of the future is going to give us opportunities we never had in the past. And so I do look forward to those changes and stuff and the ability of enhancing our, you know, so we have people that are feel confident when they're out there doing it, you know, for their, you know, on their own for the first time. So it's going to happen. I do look forward to it. Maybe
I do
not why I'm around, but it will happen.
I'm totally into the tech. I'm saying yay, and let's see how we can make it even more powerful. Because we're really talking about cadavers today, and we're at the top of the hour. I'm just going to wrap it up by saying, cadavers are amazing learning experiences, and connect with your local bequest or university programs that already do that, because we were able to get paramedics to go through any number of very complicated procedures in that. And Scotty Bolliter in San Antonio has an entire lab devoted to that. I think it's also about the respect and history of that human that you're learning about. And so it isn't just a lesson on this is what a liver is. It's also about this is so-and-so and they really, this is their trajectory and course in life I think there's just a lot of affective, affective, behavioral boost, as well as the kind of mechanical learning application.
Yeah. Well, Michael, do you have any final thoughts? We're at the top of the hour.
Yeah, I saw that. No, I thought echo what everybody else said. I can't say it any better. So that'll wrap us up.
Yeah, thank you so
Thanks
much
to the
for
authors.
helping us. And thanks to the authors for generating not only a great piece of research, but lots and lots of follow-up research questions and great issues and great discussion on sequencing. So thanks everyone for joining us. Remember, we're going to be here in July this year, Friday, July 26th. If you're around, join us. Bringing competency-based communication training to scale. So now we're going to talk about those other skills, communication training. This is a multi-institutional simulation-based mastery learning curriculum for EM residents on breaking bad news. So love this. This is about training. This is about bringing it to scale, about networking, combining our sites and doing some research together. We're going to have a great discussion July 26, 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central. So join us. But if you'd like a little dose of clinical, research, you can join the PCRF Clinical Journal Club on Monday, July 8th, with Drs. Remley Crowe and Antonio Fernandez to join us live each month. Please register at prehospitalcare.org. And remember, you can find all of our archives on the YouTube channel. Thanks very much for joining us, and we will see you next time. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.